This week on Life and Faith.
But what actually takes strength is restraint, and I'm sure we've all felt that, whether it's the bully in the schoolyard or the guy who cut you off this morning in traffic.
Yeah.
That restraint is really difficult, and that's what takes strength. And so forgiveness and reconciliation takes strength because it's not easy. It's not instinctive. If you go back to our basic human nature of wanting to retaliate, then it takes a lot of strength sometimes to hold back. But you're getting it right when it becomes an instinct and becomes natural to forgive.
We have entered into an amusing ourselves to death moment in history.
It doesn't make sense to me. If there is God, God's supposed to be free.
I was 100% sure that I was sacrificing on the altar of truth my only chance for happiness in this world.
Miracles don't necessarily change anybody's mind. It just gets their attention.
And so I had to run with my child on my back, the ISA army coming behind us.
I said, gee, Uncle George, this is luxurious for a communist. Son, he said, nothing's too good for the worker, nothing.
Welcome to Life and Faith from CPX. I'm Simon Smart.
And I'm Justine Toe.
And it's Easter week, so we want to say Happy Easter. But it feels a bit different, though, this year, doesn't it, Justine?
It has never felt like this, Simon, let's be honest. I mean, we're working from home. I think this is the first ever Life and Faith recorded in about four different homes simultaneously.
Yep.
And everything's cancelled, So I think things look pretty grim at the moment. And it seems like every day there's further carnage reported in the media. And, we know that things are projected to get worse. So it's pretty bad right now, let's be honest.
It is. But we're going to press on, do our best. I'm under a blanket here with pillows surrounding me. It's quite a sight. Anyway, it's good to see you on Zoom and our producer, Anthea, as well. Look, it's been a shocking time news-wise lately, and not just in the last 2 weeks. I mean, we've had bushfires earlier in the year. That was a huge deal in Australia. Now, everywhere, it's coronavirus time, and sometimes, it feels almost impossible, really, to take it all in without becoming a bit desensitized. And we all know that. We're aware of that anyway. But just about everyone was stopped in their tracks, in Australia at least, when earlier this year the news came out of the deaths of four children, three from the same family, two girls aged 12 and 8, and their 13-year-old brother. They were mown down on a Sydney suburban street by an alleged drunk driver while they were just walking up to the shops to buy ice cream on a really balmy summer's night.
It's really shocking, isn't it, Simon? I mean, there was another child killed. It was their cousin. So two close families have been struck by this. And they were out to buy ice cream, which is such a beautiful, fun thing to do. And this happened. It's just so unbearably tragic.
We begin tonight with an extremely difficult story to bring you. These are the beautiful faces of four children, siblings, 13-year-old Anthony, 12-year-old Angelina, 9-year-old Sienna, and their relative, 11-year-old Veronique.
The unbearable pain of a father grieving three of his six children. Danny Abdullah's sense of loss only equaled by love.
I was always say full-time father, part-time worker. They were my priority. And now they're gone.
I am sad. I am heartbroken. But I'm at peace because I know my kids are in a better place. So one thing I know, nothing happened unless God wants it to happen. I know the guy, he was drunk, driving on the streets. Right now I can't hate him. I think in my heart I forgive him, but I want the court to be fair, right? It's all about fairness. So I'm not gonna hate him, because that's not who we are, and that's not what our religious tell us.
It's such a terrible story and so tragic, so horrifically sad. But I remember that it was the response of the parents of the kids that was so astonishing. The children's father, do you remember this, Simon? Daniel Abdullah, he was quick to say they've gone to a better place. It's quite incredible, really. And Leela, his wife, the children's mum, she was somehow able to talk about forgiveness for the driver and her refusal to hate him because, as she said, that's not who we are. Who are these people, Simon? I mean, because no one can believe this reaction.
I mean, this grieving family, we all seem to come to know them, really, the Abdullah family, and they're members of the Maronite Church, which is a community that survived centuries of persecution. And it became very clear very early on that it was their faith that was central to their reaction. But even still, it was so unexpected, so radical. It really captured a lot of attention in the media. I remember a really lovely article in The Guardian by Paul Daly, who wrote that wherever that love and forgiveness came from, millions of people are pondering the beautiful, provocative mystery of it all. I thought he captured that really nicely, actually.
I think he's absolutely right, mystery. Well, Kylie Beach is a journalist for the Christian news site Eternity, and she attended a vigil for the children and the family at the crash site. Now, the scene that greeted her featured shrines for each of the children lost, filled with balloons, there were icons of saints, people were praying the rosary and singing hymns. And several priests turned out as well at what ended up being a huge community event. Now, Kylie was there to report on the event, and she didn't want to exploit the family's grief, but she found herself welcomed in by none other than Leila Abdullah. Here's what happened next.
I felt so hesitant, but they were so warm and embracing. So almost immediately, Leila had her arms around me, and she kept her arms around me, like around my waist. So I'm standing face to face with her, with this woman I've only just been introduced to, you know, with very little distance between our bodies. And she's thanking me for being there. And I'm just like stumbling over my words and trying to say thank you for how she's represented Christianity, and I'm so sorry, and you know, I wasn't speaking clearly at all because I was so overwhelmed and actually quite disoriented by the kind of inclusion and really like a hospitality, like you're welcome here in this community moment of grief, and I couldn't believe she could be so generous, and I couldn't make sense of it. And then Danny was the same when I met him. He was, you know, really glad to have me there, really willing to speak with us again in the future. And it was it was an extraordinary experience for me. And I came home really hopeful and really uplifted. Like, I'm so glad I went. That was such a beautiful experience. They're extraordinary. They've challenged the way that I think about being a Christian and think about community and my respect for the Catholic and Orthodox communities just went through the roof. And yeah, so it was a really beautiful experience. I would never wish that I hadn't done it, but it did really leave me reeling for several weeks, actually. And I don't want to make it sound like it was a happy occasion, because it was totally full of grief. I think I wrote in my article it was 100% grief and 100% hope. Like, I saw Leila lying in front of these shrines of her children where her children had died. It was the most horrible thing in the world to see, you know, like a mum laying where her children had died. And I overheard her talking to somebody who said that he'd driven past beforehand, and she said to him, "Did you see the bodies?" And he said, "Oh, no." And she said, like, "It's just as well you did, because you never will be able to forget it, because I never will be able to." And so there was like this also, that the complete horror and tragedy and grief of the situation was there as well, plus the hope. And there was somebody else whose father had died on the day, and she was again sort of comforting them. And I just got the impression this is who they are. This is how they do their life. And everyone I spoke to their next door neighbor. He, again, is a young single guy, and obviously they knew him really well and cared about, you know, him finding a great partner in life. And there was this sense that this is who they are. They're open door people. They care about others. They make space for others. And so even in this moment of grief, they were still doing what they do. They include everyone in to what's happening in their lives, and they're welcoming, and it was like autopilot. It made me think that if I learnt those hospitality skills and practiced them enough, that if I went through a really horrible time, I would go onto autopilot, and I would be able to extend hospitality and be generous and love others and do all of those kinds of things that I want to do. But I think, you know, when times are good, you obviously can forget about doing those kinds of things. You can just think about yourself. And I guess there are not that many people, I think, who would end up with such a huge community standing with them. So they're obviously extraordinary people already, and it's an extraordinary community. I don't know if it's because a lot of them are communities that, you know, they might not be, might not have migrated in this generation, but perhaps in the previous generation they had. I certainly felt very white in that space. I definitely stood out. People sort of were looking at me like I didn't belong, and I had that kind of sense of looking like I didn't belong, although they didn't treat me like that. And I get maybe it's because those communities have been persecuted and have known what it's like to leave your homeland and come to a new land. And I don't know, there is some kind of a letting old things go and embracing the journey into the new, and that tension of holding grief and hope and holding tradition and still looking forward, that they really carry. And they had a real acceptance of this life being difficult, and that not shaking their faith. And I felt like that maybe isn't something that all Christian communities or all communities have that kind of an ability to hold on to what is really devastating and still hold on to hope.
You're listening to Life and Faith from CPX, and that was Kylie Beach, who's a journalist, and Justine. We're talking about forgiveness in the lead up to Easter. But you're a mother of young children. How did you feel when you heard this story? It's pretty shocking, isn't it?
It's awful. It's every parent's worst nightmare, and that's so cliche to say, but it says it very clearly. And the fact that it's so senseless and tragic, like, it's just terrible, a terrible loss. And it's unimaginable what that family has gone through. And to hear Kylie talk about how Leela is still managing to be upright and talking to people, and not just talking to people, but to be looking out for them, is just extraordinary. Yeah. And it's so, you would not predict that this would be possible at this time, but somehow it has been possible for this woman. And Kylie said that this is who Leela actually is. And I think that's something really profound and mysterious in that. And maybe it's somehow connected to her ability to want to forgive the guy, right? But, you know, having said all that, it's so difficult to think of, you know, forgiveness as this instant response.
Yeah, how to make sense of this? I mean, if forgiveness is anything, typically it's not quick. It tends to be a process, a back and forth, and maybe living into it over time. But nonetheless, you get challenged, don't you, by some of these bold kind of radical acts of forgiveness. I mean, last year I interviewed the Coptic Orthodox Archbishop of London, Archbishop Angelos, and we're going to hear from him now because his story is closely related to this theme of forgiveness. He told the story of 20 Egyptian Copts who were kidnapped and then beheaded by ISIL in 2015. Many people would remember this horrible story. There's also another man there from Ghana. And while Archbishop Angelos was in Australia, he was promoting a book that had been written on this horrible episode by Martin Mosbach. It's called The 21, A Journey into the Land of the Coptic Martyrs. Here's Archbishop Angelos.
We're seeing the lives of 21 very ordinary men who became very extraordinary. They were members of relatively poor families from a poor village who had gone to Libya to work and then send money back to their families. They in no way went to preach or to become Christian icons, but in actual fact, the way their story unfolded made them quite symbolic of what is happening to many Christians around the world at the moment.
Yeah, so they were kidnapped while they were on construction workers, weren't they? They were kidnapped and then paraded in this awful video and then executed. What were the perpetrators of this trying to achieve by such a kind of awful, callous act?
So when they were kidnapped, they were kept for quite a while, and there were attempts to make them leave their faith, to leave their Christian faith. When they declined that, they were then paraded along a beach in Libya. And the purpose of this video was to intimidate. I think it was to dehumanize them and to intimidate their church, the Coptic Orthodox Church, as well as Christians around the world, and tell us that we were targets and that in this way we were actually defeated. But in actual fact, the example they showed, the resilience, the strength, the honor, really changed the paradigm of strength and weakness.
So the story is that they were given an opportunity to deny their faith, and they elected not to do that. Is that what we're told?
They were. They were given opportunities to deny their faith, to leave the Christian faith, but they declined. They were obviously of those, there were 20 of them who were Coptic Christians, and one man by the name of Matthew from Ghana, who stories tell us that he said, same faith, I will stay with them, whatever happens to them will happen to me.
Right. Well, it is an intimidating event, isn't it? It's a shocking kind of event, something that is sort of so awful and horrific to have. You can see how those who were responsible could think, yeah, this will have an impact on the world. What has been the impact?
Well, it certainly did have an impact, but it's not the impact they intended.
Right.
And I'm sure whoever it was who was responsible for this incredible propaganda campaign realized it had been very counterproductive, because it did cross lots of red lines. Now, as humans, we have our brokenness, we have our weakness, we have our evil. But I think those pictures exceeded even the evil of many who could have wanted to do things like that. And it was also the graciousness with which they met their death. One of the things that happened is they left the audio running. And so you could hear the men uttering the name of Jesus until quite literally their last breath. Now, that was supposed to be intimidation for us, but in actual fact, it was a testimony of faith and strength. And if anything, it encouraged and empowered Christians around the world, and it inspired non-Christians to look at what the strength was behind this paradox that changed the perception.
What do you think the strength is for someone to meet their death in such a way? Because I can't imagine myself being able to hold on to much dignity or composure in that situation at all.
Absolutely, and you'd expect, you know, when you're looking at the last moments of your life, you would retaliate, you would voice objection, you would scream and rant and rave and swear. But in actual fact, that's not what they did. What I saw was the true story of Christian understanding, that our life transcends this world, and that we know from the beginning of Christianity that Christ himself died crucified, but then rose. And that was the beginning of the church. So as a church, as the Coptic Orthodox Church, that has lived martyrdom for 2 millennia. Martyrdom is not a new idea for us. We read the Synaxarion, the Book of Saints, at every liturgy. And inevitably, every day, we are marking the life of someone who lost his or her life for his or her faith. And so for Coptic Christians, that sacrifice is something that is part of who we are. Now, don't get me wrong, we don't want to die. We cherish life, we love life, because life is a God-given gift. Yet, we know that there is a life to come as well. So I think that allows people, when they are facing those last moments, when they are facing that vulnerability, to realize that there is actually glory to come and life to come. This isn't the end of the road.
Mm-hmm. Now, I want to ask you about your reaction when you heard this news. Now, you no doubt have a responsibility to express your church's view in a manner that's fitting the office. But what about in your private moment when you heard that news? What was that like for you?
I remember the day like it was now. It was a Sunday evening. I was in London after a day at church, and I was doing a pastoral visit, and I got a call from a news agency saying, we know now that they're dead. Now, I'd been communicating with our Cairo office all day because we'd had stories backwards and forward. And they said, no, we now have video evidence they had died. And they asked me to go in for an interview. And as I was driving in, I felt that people were waiting for a response because there was this uncertainty all day. So I pulled my car over and I sent out a tweet saying it's been confirmed, the passing, we pray for them and for their families. And then I had a few characters left, and, you know, like any self-respecting, you know, person knows Twitter, you make full use of them. And so I just hashtagged Father Forgive. And I think at that point, I just felt comfort. I went into that first interview, and I did, in those 24 hours after that, probably about 30 interviews back to back the following day. And the question was constantly, how can you speak about forgiveness?
Yes, that's my question too. So you were speaking about forgiveness right from the beginning.
It was the first instinct I had. And it really was, I don't know where it came from, but I felt that was the right thing to do. And having spoken to people, members of our community around the world after that, they said that that message really brought them peace and calm. You know, our first instinct is sometimes inflammatory or sensationalist. And we set the tone. And, you know, we see it now with tweets and various people who put out, you know, very unwise things, and they set a succession of events. Whereas while we are able, if we instill a sense of peace and calm and not blurring lines, not saying nothing happened, it did happen, it is tragic, it is sad, but we pray forgiveness. And that sets the tone.
So it's not only tragic and sad, but it's also wrong. So where does, I would hear people say, okay, forgiveness, where's justice in this? And isn't there a righteous anger at this appalling treatment of other human people?
Absolutely, and that would have been completely justifiable, but it's just not what I felt.
Right.
So yes, of course, at that time, you know, and I've been, you know, please don't get me wrong, I get angry, and I got angry about other things, but at that moment, that's not what I felt. And I think, and you know, from our Christian perspective, we are human, we are vulnerable, we feel anger. But the concern is that that very natural, instinctive, organic feeling of anger can then shift into hatred or resentment. And that's the dangerous shift.
But even that would be understandable, wouldn't it, in this case?
Understandable, but not right. Because we should never let anything corrupt our hearts. Because what happens with anger is it is an instinctive reaction. But things like hatred and resentment are a violation of the heart, which makes me deal with people differently and clouds my ability then to forgive. Because I can be angry and forgive, but hatred is something much more difficult to deal with.
I'm going to ask you about forgiveness broadly then. What's the place of forgiveness, and why is it an important part of the way we relate to each other?
Well, if we never wronged, then there'd be no need to forgive. But as Christians, we're flawed and we make mistakes, and so we need to forgive each other. Now, the problem comes from me being able to see everybody else's wrong but not my own, in which case I feel that I must be forgiven because whatever I do can be justified, whereas what anybody else does isn't. The problem with not being able to forgive is that it becomes a burden that I carry around. And it stifles me. It shackles me. Forgiveness is actually a liberation. It's liberating in that I understand that I've been wronged. I understand that there is something to forgive, because without a wrong, there's no forgiveness. So we recognize there is something to forgive, but then we move through forgiveness. And it's a range of things. So there are some things that I can forgive quite easily and instinctively. There are other things that will need time and a process, and maybe others dealing with me and talking through it. Forgiveness is not always going to be instantaneous, but we should always try to move towards it.
Now, you'll be calling your people, the people of your church, towards this, but just even for the secular person who doesn't share your belief, is forgiveness something you'd also be urging them towards?
Well, I don't think forgiveness is just about belief. Yes, it's part of the Christian message, but what I said applies to everyone. Anyone knows, even if they have no belief at all, that feelings of anger and holding on to those feelings become crippling. You know, you don't want to walk into the same room as someone. You don't want to face a certain situation. You cannot cope with a certain individual. And that becomes a pattern. And so that liberation comes from the fact that I've got to do a variety of things. Either I have to face you and say, listen, you've wronged me, we need to talk this out, in which case you can forgive you. And sometimes, you know, the person in front of you is never going to take responsibility, right, and never going to face up to the problem, in which case I need to process this myself for my own good.
Yeah, that's much harder, isn't it? When the person doesn't want to even accept that they have wronged you
at all.
Why is it so hard to forgive people? Because I think it's hard to forgive people for even small things, let alone some of these big monumental wrongs that people commit against each other.
You know, going back to the Libya martyrs, even more inspiring than their own witness was the witness of their families.
Yeah, and so this is a big part of the story, isn't it? What happens back in these communities? Because there's some extraordinary reactions there.
The extraordinary reactions were women who had lost fathers, brothers, uncles, sons, suddenly coming out and saying, well, actually, I forgive. And that is superhuman. It comes from, you know, as a Christian, I would say it comes from a very deep faith, a realization that we need to transcend the mortal brokenness of this world and be able to say that we are forgiven. As humans, we are forgiven. And so we need to forgive as well. But in the secular context, I think that would come from a realization that I am hurt, but that hurt is never going to go away until I start to forgive. And it was part of a healing process.
The book that you're part of, involved with in launching here in Australia, is the book telling the story of this community, isn't it? What was the author? What did he come across when he started investigating these communities?
So the author, Martin Moserbach, who is a German Catholic, note that from the very start of his visit to this village, there was a sense of jubilation and defiance. He said he didn't walk into households that were sad or broken. He went into households that had pride in their sons and fathers and uncles, in the fact that they had witnessed to their faith. And that's just a very deep-seated faith. Now, for a non-Christian, you know, that may...
strange.
It's going to be strange. And it's going to be strange that in August of 2013, when in Egypt, 100 of our churches and places of ministry were attacked simultaneously in 48 hours, there wasn't a single act of retaliation. And in actual fact, Christians went out and wrote on the charred walls of their churches, "You shall love your enemy." So there are things that come instinctively, but that is the beauty of that. And I would invite Christians and non-Christians alike to really focus on this gift of both forgiveness, but then reconciliation.
There'd be some critics who would say talk of forgiveness in these types of situations is just weakness. you know, it's sort of lying down and allowing people to mistreat you. How would you respond to that?
I think the easiest instinct is retaliation. Hmm. Someone hits you, hit them back. Hmm. But what actually takes strength is restraint, and I'm sure we've all felt that, whether it's the, you know, the bully in the schoolyard or the guy who cut you off this morning in traffic.
Yeah.
That restraint is really difficult, and that's what takes strength. And so forgiveness and reconciliation takes strength because it's not easy. It's not instinctive. You know, if you go back to our basic human nature of wanting to retaliate, then it takes a lot of strength sometimes to hold back. Mm. But you know you're getting it right when it becomes an instinct and becomes natural to forgive.
Justine, these are hard things, aren't they? Forgiveness and reconciliation, they go so against the grain of our natural instincts.
Yeah, certainly against mine, and I think I'm pretty normal. Yeah. I feel like you totally called me out in the interview when you said it's so hard to forgive little things, let alone, you know, huge hurts. I mean, I think that's me in a nutshell. And even after listening to that, I stand in awe of what he's talking about. How do you have that instant instinct to forgive? You know, and then when he mentioned the families of the murdered men also having that reaction, it's incredible that that would be a reflex action on their part to forgive someone who's hurt them so terribly.
Yeah, in both cases, I wonder if it isn't because their different communities have experienced persecution and had to really make sense of their faith within that, centuries of this. And perhaps that's determined the shape of their life as they sort of live into that story. They've had to learn how to do that over time. It's become a practice. And because they've done it for so long, it just becomes a sort of almost a reflex response. A bit challenging, I reckon, though.
Oh, it's horrifically challenging. I mean, and if you're right, it suggests that the only way to inhabit forgiveness is to lean into it. And you lean into it by suffering. I mean, no one wants to do that. I don't want to do that.
Well, not chasing after it, I have to say. But look, it is Easter week, and the account of Easter is really such the archetypal act of forgiveness, where, according to this story, that God himself takes on the failures, absorbing the costs of all the cruelties, the thoughtless acts of humanity that cause grief and loss to others. And in this story, hate and grief don't get the last word. And so I suppose for both of these communities we've been talking about today, they would say that God makes forgiveness possible for all of us. And because of that, we ought to be able to forgive others ourselves. It's a really kind of powerful basis on which to attempt something as dangerous and challenging as forgiveness.
Yeah, and it seems to strike me that the Easter story features an aspect that we also glimpse in these stories that we've told today of the Abdullahs and Bishop Angelos, that while it costs someone enormously to forgive, the act of forgiveness itself seems to return life to other people in a surprising way. And there's something really mysterious, but also life-affirming about that.
This has been Life and Faith with me, Simon Smart, and Justine Toe. But we hope you have a safe, enjoyable, and meaningful Easter despite all the restrictions.
We'll be taking a break for a couple of weeks, but we'll be back soon. We'll also be posting links to any of the content mentioned in this episode. But for now, stay safe, wash your hands, and remember, Easter is not cancelled, even if everything else is. Check back for the first episode in the next series at the end of April.
If you like this episode, please do share it with others who you think might enjoy it as well, in their various stages of coronavirus lockdowns and what have you. We'd also love you to leave us a rating or review. It helps get the word out.